Well, first I'd like to thank the organizers for putting together this remarkable conference and for bringing us all to a beautiful location in India. I'm going to report today on work done with two graduate students at Princeton, Indrajit Mitra and Mukund Rangamani. And this is based on papers that have appeared in the past several months on HepTH. So the two parts of my talk are thematically related. In both cases, we got onto the problems because we were interested in the possibility of breaking a translation invariance by some spontaneous effect in a string theory setup. So part one will be a discussion of instabilities of black holes in anti-de Sitter space. What I'll do is to briefly revisit the Gregory-Laflamme transition, and then show how it manifests itself for spinning brain solutions, which are thermodynamically unstable. And at the end of the day, we have to do some numerical calculations to demonstrate the existence of an unstable mode. And this unstable mode leads to clumping of R charge, which might be described as phase separation. Then in part two of the talk, I'll move on to a discussion of the recently proposed quantum Hall soliton. I'll briefly recapitulate the work of a Stanford group where this setup was introduced. I'll then investigate the forces among the so-called electrons in the system and try to qualitatively describe the dynamics, in particular to investigate what the ground state is. Okay, part one. Some years ago, Gregory and Laflamme demonstrated that non-extremal black brains are often unstable. So the canonical setup would be to have some uniform black string or black brain, some uniform extended object, and compare its entropy to an array of black holes. Or if there were a conserved charge over here, like a one-brain charge, there might have to be an extremal one-brain threading this sequence of black holes. Well, Gregory and Laflamme did hard work. They just numerically computed in a perturbation analysis around the black string solution and demonstrated the existence of an unstable mode. But they gave an intuitive explanation for why it showed up. That intuitive explanation was based on a scaling argument showing that this kind of configuration would have more entropy. So in any gravitational theory where the second law of thermodynamics holds, one would expect some kind of process to take you this way, but certainly not the other way. I did not find that argument completely satisfactory because there is a distinction between global and local stability. The argument about scaling of entropy really demonstrated that there should be some global instability, which would generically be expected to proceed through some tunneling mechanism, where this classical solution would tunnel into this one. But in fact, what Gregory and Laflamme really showed was that there was a local instability of this solution proceeding in Lorentzian time, not through any tunneling mechanism, and through purely classical dynamics, not semi-classical. So I'd like to try to improve their simple explanation into something which will be quantitative, I hope, and that is to conjecture that a dynamical instability of the type they exhibited in their paper will arise precisely when there is a local thermodynamic instability. Now, what I mean by a local thermodynamic instability is the following. Suppose, from the usual rules of black hole thermodynamics, I read off the entropy as a function of energy and other conserved quantities. Then I can form this Hessian matrix and ask for it to be a negative definite matrix, or at least to have no positive eigenvalues. Well, that is a general statement of the condition for thermodynamic stability. A very simple case of it if there were no other extensive charges, a very simple case of it would be positivity of the specific heat. Furthermore, if in fact the Hessian matrix has a positive eigenvalue, then thermodynamics suggests what the unstable mode should be. In fact, you can show that if there is a positive eigenvector, then you can rearrange the local energy density and the local charge density in such a way that overall space, it is conserved, but locally variable in such a way that you can raise the entropy. That would be an example of what I would describe as phase separation. You've got some phase with more energy density, some phase with more charge density, and then another phase with less. And they coexist. And that's profitable from the point of view of getting more entropy. So my claim is that's exactly what's going on in the Gregor-Loflamin stability. However, it's difficult to go back to their original examples, their explicit numerical examples, and check that this is exactly what's going on, because it so happened the examples that they chose were always thermodynamically unstable in the local sense that I explained. Therefore, I'd like to find some non-trivial case to investigate. And the case that Indrajit and I selected was near-extremal spinning brains. That may have seemed like a difficult choice since the metrics are rather awful, but we found a simple example. So let me just tell you briefly what the setup is. We imagine we start with some P brain, which might be, say, an M2 brain or a D3 brain, and then we spin it in the directions transverse to the brain. So the spin is rotation that leaves the world volume stationary. And the angular momentum in this direction, this JY1, Y2, from the world volume point of view, it's a conserved R charge. So it would qualify as one of these QAs. And we could ask, for instance, is the thermodynamics stable? Well, spinning brains are, in fact, very well investigated. There are papers from years ago by Cvetic and Yum, writing down most of the solutions. There are extensive studies of the thermodynamics, to which we added a little bit. And we found, through explicit computation, that this Hessian matrix has its negative definite property, which was necessary for stability, if and only if the angular velocity was less than the temperature up to a factor of order unity. And this is something which applies, albeit with different C1s, for M2 brains, D3 brains, and M5 brains. And I've, for simplicity's sake, considered only a single angular momentum, but it can be generalized to the case of several. Well, what's going on here from the world volume point of view? I can't be sure because it's a strongly coupled theory that we're talking about. But what I would suggest is that there's some kind of Bose condensation that's going on, and that the new phase that's nucleating is a Bose condensed phase. In fact, there are transverse scalars, which we might call X1 plus or minus IX2, which carry the U1R charge under consideration. That is to say, the U1R charge, which is really the world volume manifestation of this angular momentum that we called spin. So if these scalars pick up some thermal mass, which is the temperature up to this factor of order unity, then this condition here becomes precisely the condition to avoid Bose condensing. And that's why I think that it's reasonable to say that this instability is an instability toward nucleating a Bose condensed phase. Well, this all sounds very nice, but we might ask factor fantasy. We have only thermodynamic arguments so far. We'd like to know, is there some definite check of the conjecture in classical gravity? And the answer is yes for the following particular case. If you look at spinning M2 brains now with all four independent angular momenta equal, and you take its near horizon limit, what you wind up with is the ADS4 Reister-Nordström solution cross a 7-sphere. If you then Kaluza Klein reduce so that the seventh sphere goes away and is replaced by scalars summarizing its shape, what you wind up with is the four-dimensional geometry of ADS4 Reister-Nordström, and then some scalars and some gauge fields, which come from the S7. Now, as I described earlier, when there is a thermodynamic instability, the eigenvector, which is unstable, should tell you what mode is unstable in gravity. Well, you can look at the thermodynamics, I'm not going to do it explicitly, and show that this kind of mode is the one that's unstable, where these four charges, which started out equal, become unequal, but only pairwise. Okay, so then you can go back to your gravity description. You can work in this Kaluza-Klein reduced language for the sake of simplicity, and write down the part of the Lagrangian which is relevant to the description of this particular mode. And it's a reasonably simple Lagrangian. Just gravity, a scalar, two gauge fields. The scalar, by the way, violates the dominant energy condition, so it's not clear a priori whether there will be stability or not. Let me not drag you through very much of the calculation, but only show you the metric, which is the first line, the gauge fields, which is the second line, and the perturbation, and finally the linearized equations around this solution that result from this Lagrangian. Okay, so we wind up with some coupled equations, still a little bit nasty. However, the analysis is greatly facilitated by the use of spinorial or dyadic indices. That's, in fact, why we chose the ADS4 case, because we knew we could do it. Well, you go about your business. You decouple these equations. You get a fourth-order ordinary differential equation in the end. Give it to Mathematica. And Mathematica comes back and tells you that there is, indeed, an instability. Moreover, that instability occurs exactly when it's supposed to, that is to say, exactly when the thermodynamics becomes unstable. And lest there be some misimpression, I should say that this point is in no way special geometrically. The horizon is smooth. There is no ergosphere, not even in 11 dimensions. And furthermore, it was not essential that I had the asymptotically flat space tacked on. I could equally well do this in global ADS4. And so I would say, in conclusion, that no-hair theorems are violated in an interesting way in anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so let me move on now to part two of my talk, which was work with Mukund Rangamani. We wanted to investigate this fascinating D-brain arrangement that was introduced by the Stanford group just a couple months ago. The purpose of their paper was to try to find some D-brain configuration which would, in its infrared limit, exhibit fractional quantum Hall behavior. And we wanted to ask ourselves, does it or doesn't it? It seemed to me at first that something analogous to phase separation would inevitably occur. And so I looked, and this time I found not so, or at least not so locally. I've drawn this configuration of brains that Brnovich, Brody, Suskin, and Tupas introduced. What you've got is a bunch of D6 brains extended out of the transparency, surrounded by a D2 brain in the shape of an S2. Bound to that D2 brain are a bunch of D0 brains. The D6 brain attracts the D2 brain but repels the D0 brains. On the other hand, the D0 brains are bound to the D2 brain, so it doesn't take too much imagination to realize that there is, in fact, a stable equilibrium radius. Furthermore, there have to be these fundamental strings on account of the Hanani-Witten effect. So I've made a list of sort of relevant points of interest, which are either pointed out in this Stanford paper or which are essentially obvious once you've thought about it a little bit. In particular, this is a nearly supersymmetric setup, but not quite. Supersymmetry is broken on the D2 brain world volume on a scale comparable to the circumference of the 2-sphere. Finally, another thing to wring your hands about a little bit is that these Hanani-Witten strings are fermions in their ground state as strings. However, you have to tie together the Chan-Patton indices at the D6 brain in some way, and the most obvious way would be to use an antisymmetric symbol. Therefore, it seems most obvious to suppose that the ends of the string on the D2 brain behave as bosons. That's not particularly essential to the analysis because fractional quantum Hall effects can occur for bosons as well as fermions, provided interactions are repulsive. So the questions we might ask are, first of all, does this system indeed have a ground state well approximated by a Laplace wave function? And oh, I realize that now that I wrote the Laplace wave function for a quantum Hall droplet on the plane, what I suppose I really should have done was to nix the Gaussian, because this is on a sphere, and use stereographic coordinates. Anyway, it's a combination of lowest Landau levels, which has a particular property that the large power here, m, holds the electrons far apart and therefore minimizes some repulsive Coulomb energy. That's why this is a good choice in real quantum Hall systems. It's because this factor vanishes so fast when the electrons get close together. Well, supposing there indeed is a ground state well approximated by the Laplace wave function, we would next ask, is there quantum Hall phenomenology? For instance, is there quantized transverse conductance? And finally, we might ask a question dear to my heart, do we expect inhomogeneous phases, for instance, a Wigner crystal or a stripe phase? In fact, both such phases are seen in real quantum Hall systems, and it's fairly well understood when and why they occur. Well, to address any of these questions, we have to understand the inter-electron forces. And those turn out to be perhaps a bit more complicated than one might at first think. The effective action on the D2 brain, or at least the relevant part of that action for my story, is written here. We've got a background charge from a topological constraint to soak up the flux lines of the electrons. We have a kinetic term for the gauge boson, the U1 gauge boson that arises on the D2 brain world volume. We've got a Chern-Simons mass term for that gauge boson. Then we have this scalar phi, which is always going to denote radial fluctuations around that stable equilibrium radius of the D2 brain. So this scalar has some mass, which is the second derivative of the potential at that stable radius. I've written only the quadratic part of the action here, and only the bosonic part. That's all I'm going to need, really. But there are, of course, fermions and interactions. In particular, this whole action should be viewed as a non-commutative action, but that only matters for the interaction terms. And finally, of course, there are couplings of both the gauge boson and this radial scalar to the strings. There are not couplings at linear order of the strings to any of the other scalars in the D2 brain because the strings are running radially. Okay. Well, some of the hard work here was to actually pin down all these numbers, which I've now listed. The mass, the Chern-Simons mass of the photon in units of the radius of the S2 is this funny number, 3 over 4 root 2. The scalar is rather heavier, which is good news. And I'll tell you why in a moment. I'm working in a coordinate system where the metric on the D2 brain has been rescaled by a conformal factor. So don't get confused. If this power 1/3 looks strange to you, it's just because I'm using an unusual choice of frame. Finally, an important point is that the Yang-Mills coupling is weak. That's because we're close to a D6 brain. And that enables us to indeed use only the quadratic part and integrate out the photon and the scalar in order to find the force exerted by one electron on another. Okay, so this is exactly what we want to do. We want to just find the inter-electron force. And there was a little argument that Mukin and I put together to the effect that closed string exchange between strings emanating from the D6 brain, closed string exchange is a negligible effect by comparison to the open string exchange on the D2 brain world volume. In other words, we have enough of a decoupling limit on this soliton for gravity to essentially be negligible. Okay, so the reason that it's important that the photon was less massive than the scalar was because the photon induces a repulsion, which, if the scalar weren't there, would be the dotted orange line. And the scalar induces an attraction. So the photon being lighter means that the repulsion is stronger and will win, in fact, at all separations. So I've used on the horizontal axis theta to indicate the separation of two electrons. So there's a maximum of energy when the electrons are coincident, and then a minimum when they are diametrically opposed. And just for the sake of clarity, I've drawn the second derivative of V as well. For very small separations, you can figure out an approximate form for this potential. It goes as theta squared log theta. And now you have to go back to these numbers that we laboriously computed to figure out how strong this propulsion is. Then you have to compare it to the cyclotron gap and decide whether it was indeed a good idea to project down to the lowest Landau level. There's a figure of merit describing whether that's a good idea or not. It's the ratio of a typical interaction energy divided by the cyclotron gap. And for us, this number turned out to be 1 over the filling fraction nu. A priori, you would want to demand that this is a small number in order for projection onto the lowest Landau level to be valid. Well, for us, it didn't turn out to be parametrically small, but at least it was not parametrically large. So if I were going to be very optimistic, I would say that the Laughlin wave functions have a reasonable chance of being the ground state for nu on the order of 1, not too small, but still less than 1. Let me elaborate on that a little bit, because it might not seem believable the way I said it. If repulsions are very strong, then it's certainly a bad idea to project down to the lowest Landau level in order to find an approximate ground state. Instead, the likeliest ground state is a Wigner crystal, where the electrons are localized far apart. And for small nu, this surely wins out over any fractional quantum Hall wave function. As I said, this doesn't seem so good. However, you should remember that the electrons are really quite close together. So nearest neighbors actually interact very weakly. And this figure of merit is actually bigger than it really should be. So there's a naive analysis which suggests that fractional quantum Hall versus Wigner crystal is a difficult thing. But I think if you look more carefully, it will turn out that for a finite range of nu, the fractional quantum Hall state will be the winner. And there are certainly more systematic methods than just this kind of rule of thumb for deciding that. And it's a direction that we have begun to explore. Well, let's take it as given, then, that there is at least some range of nu where the fractional quantum Hall state wins out. Now let's ask a question which, in fact, other authors have addressed as well, Bena and Nudelman. Let's ask the question whether this ground state, well, whether it's really a ground state against spherical perturbations. So in order to do that, what we should do is consider the potential energy for some continuous distribution of charge. This turns out to be a completely stable positive potential, but only barely, because there's a very fast fall off of the coefficients with the partial wave number. So the conclusion is that, assuming again that a fractional quantum Hall state is the ground state, yes, it's stable, against S2 perturbations, but not by much at high partial waves. Therefore, we might worry that if you included nonlinear effects, there might be some competing vacuum that would be a Stride phase, and these competing vacua would be very close in energy. In any case, it seems to me quite doubtful that the quantum Hall fluid would be incompressible. It was incompressible in real systems because there was a rather smaller fall off in the potential. In other words, if you squeeze the quantum Hall fluid locally, it protests a lot, whereas this one barely protests at all. So I don't think there will be any quantum Hall phenomenology above this ground state. Probably even there is no gap. And then, of course, there's another point that there's no dirt. So there's no way you're going to localize quasi-particle excitations, and rho xy won't be quantized. All these difficulties arose essentially from the existence of the scalars. The scalars are what are messing things up. So if we could take away the scalars or make them much more massive, then the story would be better. In summary, a reasonable guess for the dynamics of this system is that for small nu, interactions are actually quite strong, and a Wigner crystal would inevitably be the ground state. For intermediate nu, I would guess maybe bigger than a tenth, less than one. The fractional quantum Hall effect, a fractional quantum Hall ground state should, in fact, pertain, at least at filling fractions, which are 1 over an integer. But I think the gap should be parametrically small in the thermodynamic limit where the number of D0 brains goes to infinity. Finally, for large filling fractions, things go haywire. Not only are there higher Landau levels, but there are also stringy excitations at the same energy scales, which would change, for instance, the statistics of the electrons. So who knows what happens there. So as I said, if you include nonlinear effects, it could easily be that some clumping effect could arise, and that could be investigated using the technique of bions, and that's another thing which we'd like to do if we can muster the courage. Also, as I mentioned before, the difficulty that we had with the quantum Hall fluid being so compressible and the mass gap being small, they arise precisely because the scalar is there mediating an attraction, at least at short ranges, between the electrons. So if this scalar were very heavy or absent, then we would be much more entitled to expect real fractional quantum Hall behavior. And that comment might be compared to the recent paper of Suskind that appeared only a few days ago. Well, to summarize, now that I'm out of time, in the first part of my talk, I proposed a thermodynamic criterion for the existence of Gregor-Leflam instabilities. And this was supposed to be a quantitatively correct criterion. Indrajit and I checked it for a particular case, the spinning M2 ring. And we got for free unstable black holes and ADS as a bonus. And then in the second part of the talk, I described these inter-electron forces for the quantum Hall soliton and how they influence the choice of ground state and its stability. Thank you very much.
Okay, questions?
I have a question to the first part of your talk. There is another possibility how Gregor-Leflam instability could go. Instead of decaying into a net of black holes, the brain could just expand along in its internal directions. And, brain tension could play the role of cosmological constant on the world volume of the brain. Although nobody showed explicit solution, nobody ever found the explicit solution how it goes, this mechanism seems to be plausible because it doesn't pass through Nick singularities. And can you, using your techniques, say something in favor or against the second mechanism?
Actually, I'm not quite sure what you mean. Do you mean that the brain world volume should still be a homogeneous surface, but one of constant curvature rather than zero curvature?
Yeah, and will expand along internal directions. Well, no,
I would say there are no internal directions here. So I don't know what you mean again. Perhaps we should discuss it in private. I'm afraid I don't quite comprehend the question.
More questions? If there are no more questions, let us thank the speaker again.